Making a recipe that calls for butter? Make it better with European butter from France. With a minimum of 82% butterfat, it's no wonder French butter is the number one choice for chefs the world over. Whether you're whipping up an omelet, sauteing vegetables, or spreading it on toast, the rich, cultured flavor of butter from France always elevates. Be sure to look for Made in France on the label, and for recipes, tips, and tricks, go to tasteeurope.com.
You know, you're going to look it up anyway. Like, if a reader is reading a recipe in a cookbook, doesn't know how to do something, the first thing you're going to do is open up your phone, go on Google, and pull up a YouTube video about how to do it. So I'm like, why don't I just make this easy for you and put the video right in there for you?
You're listening to The Taste Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Rodbard. I've long been a fan of author and creative thinker Molly Baz, and many of you have too. With a signature voice and wild recipe development skills, as well as years of professional cooking under her belt, Molly has won over millions of fans worldwide. Her book, Cook This Book, was a New York Times bestseller, and we talk about some of the many things she's been up to since the release a little over a year ago. We find out about her move from New York to the West Coast, and what it was like growing up in New York's Hudson Valley. Lastly, we talk about a new book in the works, which will be dropping very soon. I really love this conversation with Molly Baz. Welcome to the Taste Podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, I'm excited to catch up with you. It's been, I think I talked to you about a year ago, and a lot has happened. But the club is like a huge success. It's really fun. It's full of energy and life. But it also seems like it's so much freaking work.
It is so much freaking work. But it's like my freaking job, you know? the club is my membership only recipe club. It's like the only place in the world really where new Molly Baz recipes exist. After I left Bon Appetit, I had to think long and hard about like, where is my content going to live now? Because I don't have a platform for it. I didn't love the idea of it being just on Instagram because I wanted it somewhere more permanent. And I also wanted it in a place where I could like build a little community around it. And so that's why I started the club. And so it's basically like a newsletter, but it's a recipe club. And I actually recently sort of like redesigned and revamped the whole thing. So it was once on Patreon. And I didn't love that because I like to really be in control of how things look and like kind of the world I'm creating for around me and for our community. And so I ended up porting off of Patreon and onto my own website. So now it's like, it's fun. It like feels like an actual like editorial site where you like, if you join and you sign into the club, you have like the whole archive with all of the recipes and you can like search it the way you would any other food website. But it's just like all the content that I've been creating since I launched it, like a year and a half ago.
Yo, so cool. It's like a full, it feels like a real Condé Nast, like Time Inc. publication. Like it's not just Patreon, like respect to that. And I like that you do like giveaways too. That seems very exciting.
Yeah. I want it to feel like it had more value than just like, oh, here's a recipe a week. And so there are other elements to it. Like you mentioned, I do a monthly giveaway. So I have relationships at so many food brands just from being in the industry. And they're always like so thrilled to and so generous to with like sharing their product with the club. So like, for example, this month, my friends over at KitchenAid, who I've worked with several times in the past, are just giving away 3 stand mixers to the club. Like just like 3 people at random will be chosen from the club and they'll receive KitchenAid stand mixers, which is such an expensive item that is like such a splurge. And so fun for people to be able to participate in that. But then also there's other elements of it, I think, that like make it feel a little bit more food publication-y, which is that I host like guest chefs in the club. And so it's not actually just Molly recipes anymore because that felt a little bit tunnel vision-y to me. And so I about once a month or so bring, you know, some of my industry friends and people that I look up to who are also recipe developers into the club to do guest recipes. So that's been really fun.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about A Straight Away because I think it's really cool that you're, you know, you've left your, you know, your job at VA and you've done cookbooks, but you're like running your own business and it's really high quality and it's hard. I mean, what's it like running your own business?
It's like way more work than it was working for someone else. I will say that.
Yeah.
It's also, I think, way more gratifying for me. And I really could not do it if not for my manager, who is basically just like my second in command and like keeps my shit together with me. I didn't have a manager when I first launched myself out into the world on my own. And it was a real shit show. And so it's really thanks to like all the people around me who helped make it all happen. But it's, you know, what it's like, creating, having a to-do list that is 27 items long every day and not feeling overwhelmed by that, because otherwise you crumble and it's over.
Yeah. You have to like compartmentalize. I know the feeling. I like that you say it's gratifying, because I think when you take control of your destiny and you start your own business, you're taking a risk, but you also, there's a huge payoff. So
totally. And I think like what's so exciting about it and what also makes it so much work is that like there is no ceiling and there's no limit to what I can do. Whereas when I worked for Condé Nast and there was like, I was working within the confines of that company and I was in a contract and there were limitations to what I was able to do outside of my job description. And now it's like, I make my own job description. I make my own limitations. And so if I want to launch another brand or launch a wine company, which we can talk about later, I can just do that. And that is really, really empowering. It's a very different feeling. And I think I really thrive off of that.
So when we talked last, we talked about your cookbook, which had just been released. And you know, right away, I was like, yo, QR codes in a cookbook, you know, you did it right. I thought it was really exciting. And I wanted to follow up on that, because in hindsight now that it's been out a year, are you finding those QR codes? Do people actually use them in your book? And would you put them in future books?
Yeah, I knew I was going to come on here, I did a little bit of research to look at the stats and how those were doing recently. And I think it's been a big success. I think in the last like 3 or 4 weeks, there's been 5,000 views on the QR codes. Granted, there are probably only like 18 QR codes in the book that, you know, represent 18 really fundamental techniques. And so for me, that means like 5,000 people learned how to do something in the last month that they didn't know how to do, which is so awesome. And I've also heard that since my book came out, a bunch of cookbooks are now in the pipeline that have incorporated QR codes that are not yet out yet, because of course the publishing circuit takes a couple
glacial.
Of years.
Glacial.
Yeah. I'm excited to see that like it's having an impact on the industry and that other people are now going to incorporate technology into cookbooks, because why not? I mean, it's like, it's 2022. Why would we not integrate those two things? It seems silly almost not to.
No, it seems silly. And like you always have your phone by your side. And if you're reading and you're cooking and you just want to learn how to, you know, do a quick technique,
you know, you're going to look it up anyway. Like if a reader is reading a recipe in a cookbook, doesn't know how to do something, the first thing you're going to do is open up your phone, go on Google and pull up a YouTube video about how to do it. So I'm like, why don't I just make this easy for you and put the video right in there for you?
Do you have the pang for a next book? Do you have that like little feeling inside that you want to do another book?
Oh, it is well underway. It's
okay,
more than
good.
A feeling. it's a lifestyle. yes, I am about 3/4 of the way through writing my second book. It's due in a couple of months. I just shot the first half of all the recipes last week, actually. So my house was fully taken over by a camera crew. And it's really crazy and mind-blowing to like see it all happen again. I don't know how I got here. I don't know where the time went. I don't know how I'm doing it again. I especially don't know how I even have like any ideas left inside me, because I feel like I gave so much to the last book and all of a sudden I'm like, oh my gosh, I have more to say. Like, who knew? And so, yeah, I'm very, very excited about the second one. I feel like I worked out the kinks of the first. I learned a lot, and this one's going to be stellar.
So what can you tell us about the actual recipe development? Like, are there, or is there one recipe that was like your grail in the recipe development process that you're like, I nailed this one, at least now? Give us a little bit of preview.
In the new book?
Yeah.
I'll say there's one recipe that took, at a minimum 18 passes at, like 18 different tests. And for whatever reason, I just decided not to abort mission, which normally I would. I don't want to give too much away about the concept of the book because I haven't actually like announced it to the world yet. But I think what's been really cool about this book is like the way it's forced me to look at ingredients in new ways, and that will be more clear sort of when it all comes out. But yeah, I mean, the recipe development process was, I think, a lot easier this time than it was the first time. And I think that's mostly because the first time around, I was working on my recipes at the end of the day after coming home from a full-time job in the test kitchen at Bon Appetit. And so I would have to then return to my tiny apartment kitchen in Brooklyn and make a whole ass mess again all night long after having done it all day long. And now it, like, the book feels more sort of like integrated into like my daily life, which like I'm really enjoying, that I'm like able to really like live it day in and day out.
Yeah, it'll show in the book. I can't wait to have you back and talk about it.
Yeah.
You grew up in upstate New York. Let's talk about, I live in like Hudson Valley-ish area myself.
You do? Where are you?
I do. I live in Orange County.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I moved a couple of years ago, but I'm in the city. We're recording this now from Midtown, but I want to know about upstate life. Like, what was it like growing up? What were you eating? What was it like? What was your life like?
Oh my gosh. It was bucolic and idyllic and not necessarily the upstate or the Hudson Valley that we all know now today. Mm-hmm. Like, when I was growing up, it wasn't like a destination place. I grew up in like the Red Hook Rhinebeck area in the Hudson Valley, which is very close to the campus of Bard College. And so like my community and my family's community was very much built around the community at Bard. And so I grew up, you know, all my family friends were very like liberal and eccentric and artistic and creative. But it wasn't like the foodie destination that it is now. And also like, I just think like food culture was a different thing back then. Like, we didn't fetishize food culture the way we do now when I was growing up. And so it wasn't even really like on my parents' radar to like think outside the box or seek things out, like seek delicious things out that are like, that were from upstate. And so I ate in a very plain way growing up, which is so funny to think about now, because now my parents are like so integrated into food culture just like because of me and what I do, that like we eat really well and we eat interestingly and we like seek things out. But growing up, like, I think the meal that was most often served on my table was either, you know, like just breaded chicken cutlets with frozen or steamed peas and a glass of milk, or like a meatloaf or buttered noodles and meatballs. Like, it was really, really simple food. And our family did not revolve around it. And so my life now just revolves around it in such an intense way that it's sort of like crazy to me that wasn't a part of my upbringing.
Did you teach your mom or your family, have you taught them some moves? You said that you were kind of like the gateway drug to foodieism. And it sounds like it's a very common story. It's like a younger generation passing on foodie. And I'm embracing the term foodie, so just shout out to that. I'm just going there.
But we love a foodie.
I feel like love a foodie. But like, is there something that you taught them, like when you were working in kitchens?
Yeah, my dad especially like really took to food and cooking when I did. I spent a semester abroad in Italy, which we may have talked about on the last pod, but which was kind of where I had this like come to Jesus moment. Was like, oh my God, I need to cook. Like, that's my life's calling. And I came back from Italy, was living with my parents over the summer. And my dad and I just got so into Tuscan cooking after that trip. And he like really, something that's really amazing about him is that he will like really take on his children's interests and like immerse himself in them. And so he got really into Tuscan cooking, and he sort of like follows like what I'm cooking. And he's always sending me articles that he's reading in the New York Times about like whatever new up and coming fun things are happening in food and trying out new recipes. And it's different now than it was then. I feel like all of our eyes have been opened a bit to like what food can provide. And so he's right there with me.
That's pretty rad. Now back to your upbringing. Did you make it down to New York City when you were young? And did you have any like restaurant experiences when you were young that like you still think about like, wow, that was like 18 or younger?
I did go to the city a lot when I was young. My grandfather lived there. He lived on the Upper East Side, and the only restaurant experience that like sticks with me the most was some, and I don't know what it is, which one it was anymore, French bistro that was like down below his apartment or on the block or around the corner. And we used to go there all the time. And at that point I just thought like French food was everything, you know, like just going into a French restaurant felt like the biggest splurge, the biggest sort of like treat, out of my element, because like no one was making French food at my home. And like even just like, you know, going into like one of those classic kind of like brasserie vibes where there's like Toulouse-Lautrec like artwork on the walls and everything, like I felt like in New York I was able to like immerse myself in food cultures that I couldn't upstate. And so I just remember like being really sort of like captivated by this French bistro where I'm sure I had like, you know, French onion soup and and a croque madame,
steak au poivre.
Yeah, like the classics, which now are like maybe not as impressive to me, but like were at the time for me just like absolutely everything.
I mean, talk about people watching too. Like you're transplanted into like the Upper East Side into a bistro below your grandfather's house.
And I mean,
like,
yeah, like, that could, that's couldn't like, be more
that's
different.
That's like extra New York. Yeah.
I grew up, I mean, when I say bucolic, like really I grew up at the end of a dead end road. Like there's a big, beautiful, like pasture that you drive by on the way there with like one enormous single oak tree in the middle and like rolling hills. I'm telling you, like it was not urban at all where I grew up.
No. Oh, did you live near Tivoli at all?
Yes.
Do you ever go to Hotel Tivoli?
Oh, yes, of course. Hotel Tivoli. And there was, I don't know, we used to go to the Black Swan growing up, which was like the dive bar in town in Tivoli. And yeah, Tivoli is great.
Yeah, Tivoli has a new performance center, Kotzbahn, which I just went to this past summer.
Oh, yeah, my parents go all the time.
It's really cool. So yeah, this is like tourism board for upstate Red
Hudson
Hook
Valley.
But still, like, I want to talk about transitioning over to your move to LA, because you moved during the pandemic. And how are you finding it? You're like an East Coast kid. Like, what was that move like? And do you have a lot of friends now? Is it hard to move to the West Coast?
Okay, so let me tell you the story of my transition out to LA, because it kind of contextualizes it all. The week that the pandemic really hit and everyone started to work from home, at least in America, was I think in early March of 2020. Yeah. And I got the email from Condé Nast that was like, everybody's been ordered to stay home. We're going to work from home until further notice. Like, we have no idea what the hell is happening out here, but stay safe. No one get on the subway. Don't come to work. And my husband had flown to Palm Springs for a vacation with his family just like 3 days prior, when it was like, there was like murmurings of the pandemic, but like no one really expected it to like shut the world down, you know? And so he just proceeded to go on his family vacation in Palm Springs. So I got the email and it was like, stay home until further notice. And I was living at the time in an apartment building in Greenpoint where there was like 50 units. And I started to kind of freak out. Like, I was like, my husband's not here. I have to stay home alone. What if like he can't get on a plane back to me? Cause what if like no one's allowed to leave or travel? And then in order to get into my building, I got to go into an elevator and there's like a lot of other people. What if I get this COVID thing that like, it was just, I was like felt very sort of like out of sorts and decided like just in that moment, like, fuck it. I'm getting on a plane. I'm going to meet my husband. Cause like whatever happens, I want us to be in the same place. What if we get, you know, strewn apart from one another for months? And so I was like, hey, babes, I'm coming. Like, I'm going to get on a plane. I'm bringing Tuna, our dog. And like, I'm just going to come out there and vacation with you guys because I'd rather be in Palm Springs in a pandemic than New York. And
wise move, yeah. Molly, wise.
And
move.
Then our week vacation ended and we were supposed to go home. And after that week, it was clear that like it was very unsafe to get on a plane. And so we decided, let's just extend our stay by a week or two. We found an Airbnb in Joshua Tree in the desert that felt like safe because it was completely remote and there was no one around. We were like, let's post up here a couple of weeks. We did that. 2 weeks went by. Things did not let up, as we all know. We extended our stay for another 2 weeks. We ended up living in the desert for almost 3 months.
My gosh.
And
dang.
At which point we were, you know, fully in the pandemic and we hadn't seen a soul or spoken to a soul. Like we were just isolated in the desert. And I was like, this is getting weird. Let's go to LA.
Seems like very, very, very like kind of jarring to go from Greenpoint to like living in the desert. And
yeah,
you didn't even
mention,
have Pappy
like,
and Harriet's to hang out at.
We left all of our belongings at home. Like I literally had like my bathing suit and like a few things for the week for my vacation. So we decided to go to LA because I had family there and I was like, let's go see some family and like in a safe way as much as we can, but like at least be around civilization. And so then we transported our bags to LA and rented an Airbnb in LA for a couple of weeks. And that turned into a couple of months. And then one day a friend of ours was like, you need to look at this house. And who's in real estate. And we were like, okay. Cause we were just like curious about, you know, like real estate out here. And she took us to see it. And I was like, that's our house. And we bought the house and never ever went home. And so I hired a moving company to go into my apartment in Greenpoint and pack all of our things up. Like there was dirty dishes.
No shit, really?
Yeah, yeah. Like laundry in the machine, like shit all over the floor. Just like I walked out of that apartment so fast. I was like, get me out of here, this pandemic, and didn't walk back into it ever again. And so they shipped it all out here and we've lived here ever since.
Have you even been back to New York?
I have now, like since, yeah. You know, I went back like a year ago or whatever. Maybe a year and a half before I went home. And I love it out here. I mean, I have always, I think, like given off some kind of LA energy because whenever people meet me, they're like, they assume I'm from LA, which is strange because I grew up in upstate New York, very, very different place. But for whatever reason, definitely. That's the vibration they get. And I had been sort of like toying with the idea of like, will I ever live in LA for so long? It felt like it forced something that was like deep within me for a long time. And I love it here. Like I like the lifestyle. I like we have so much more space and we breathe clean air. And like, as corny as it is, like I am more in touch with nature than I was in New York, which wasn't even on my radar. And I live in Altadena, which is like very far out, like up in the mountains. We have a bear that comes to our house like 3 or 4 times a week and just like walks down our front steps and like gets in our garbage. Like we out here. And it is just
crazy. Yeah, you are out there. Yeah. I gotta ask you a Palm Springs question. Do you ever go to Billy Reed's, the pie spot, the pie and diner? Do you ever go there?
No, but do I need to know about it? Because I am going out in a couple of weeks.
Oh, you have to go to Billy Reed's. Yeah, Billy, and ask for Billy. He's the most wonderful man. And he's
how
Palm
have I
Canyon.
Never heard of that? I've been there so many times.
Yeah, it's you know, it's not on like the Coachella hit list. Not that you're hitting that. I'm not assuming that, but it's like a little. It's an established old. It's like walking into a restaurant in like 1984.
Oh my god,
it's
my
like
favorite.
So great. It's really great, and the pies I think are excellent. I highly recommend it. Billy Reed's. I'll email you the info. It's great.
Okay,
and
so fun.
I feel Cecil too is pretty dope there. I have to, you know, shout out to Cecil, Bar Cecil.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, I can't wait to go. I'm so excited. I love that. I love how Palm Springs feels like it's like caught in time. It's like in the 70s.
Yeah. What about LA though? Let's do a scene check. Like what's happening there? I feel like Combi's about to open on the West Side. Akira is always posting stuff.
Yep.
Like I have to ask you like what's happening in the city and then we'll talk about wine.
Okay. So here's the thing. I'm like pretty behind the times when it comes to LA, like food and restaurants, because for the first year that I was out here, no restaurants were open or they were only doing takeout. And I kind of like made a rule that I was like, I'm not going to go try all these iconic spots like via takeout. Like, let's just wait till they're back open. And so even though I've been here for I don't know, almost years, I've only like started to scratch the surface of all of the like kind of iconic restaurants that are out here that everyone always talks about. So it's kind of exciting for me because I feel like even though I've been here for a while, like the food scene and the culinary scene here is like, there's so much to discover for me still in terms of restaurants. I mean, I'm sure you've heard about Found Oyster, which is like maybe my favorite place on the planet, which is just the best like seafood spot in LA. And there's actually not a lot of seafood here, which I think is funny and interesting given how close we are to the coast. But Found Oyster is such a special little gem of a spot right in the middle of the city. So we go there a lot. What else? We've done like the classic like taco tour, like hit up all the joints because that's like so new and fresh to me. Like in New York, I never ate tacos. I ate like if it was like a late night bite for me, it was a slice of pizza most of the time. Or it was like I'm going into a bodega and I'm like raiding the potato chip shelf. But here it's like I've eaten so many tacos since getting here. We've gone to Boyle Heights several times and like we try to use the lists that are out there and then like kind of go rogue also, because I find oftentimes that the lists are like overhyped and like things get, you know, spots get on the list and then like everybody goes there and there's like places that are like just as amazing down the street. There's this one place called Tacos Arandinos, which is like right in Boyle Heights, that just has the most delicious al pastor tacos that we, whenever we're in the area, we go to. Where else have I been going? Oh my gosh. I went recently. This is not a new restaurant. This is not like new on the scene, but like so classic and iconic. You've got to go next time you're here. It's called The Smokehouse. Have you heard of it?
No, I haven't. Where is that?
Okay. So it's in Burbank and it's a like old school American steakhouse that is like completely untouched. And
yeah, sounds like Burbank. Sounds like over there.
Yeah. The like, you know, the clientele is like 80 plus and you know, sidecar martinis, like the whole thing. There's live music. The food is like a 5 or 6 out of 10, but the vibes are like 7 million out of 10. And so like,
I've like Palm Springs.
Yeah. It's a Palm Springs vibe. So we've been going there a lot with big groups of friends, which is so fun. I really never get to the West Side, unfortunately, which I guess is such a boring classic LA story, but I live so far east that like, it really is like going.
Yeah, it's a real hike to go west of the 405. Yeah, I'm sure there's
a couple hours. It's like it's a big commitment. but I'm still kind of like getting through my list of everything. There's a place in Silver Lake that opened up recently called Bar Maruno that I really want to check out, which is like Spanish tapas, tinned fish, natty wine spot.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there's so much. I feel like my list is so long and it's very exciting to be so fresh here. And
I love it. I always hit up LA Taco for my my intel for tacos. I feel like that's
of course.
I go straight to those guys.
A great source.
Yeah. Let's talk about you're launching a wine club called Drink This Wine with Andy Young, which I know a BA favorite, Andy Young.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's not a wine club. It's a wine company.
Great. Oh, so wow. Let's step back and say, yo, that's bigger than a club. It's a company, not a club.
We're starting a company. Okay.
I love it.
Yeah.
It's great.
So I'm launching a wine label basically. It's with Andy Young of the Marigny, which, probably many of the listeners here will know or recognize his wines. Andy is like an OG Portland natural winemaker who I met while working at Bon Appetit. He was sort of like the natural winemaker darling of all of our events. And so he was always around and always sending us wine. And we got to know each other a little bit there and then stayed in touch and have just been sort of like friends ever since and just chatting and talking. And I love drinking wine and he loves making wine and we get along so well. And so just over the last like year and a half or so, we kind of decided like, let's start a new wine company together.
That's cool.
He's, you know, he's excited about a new venture. He's, you know, the Marigny will still exist, but he'll be focusing a lot of his efforts on our company, which is called Drink This Wine. And it's going to start small and then we're going to get bigger and everything is going to be like fresh and vibrant and and juicy. And I think that what's so exciting about it for me is that Andy is a winemaker. He's like my partner in this business. He's so in tune with food and flavor. And the first thing that he did when we like started talking about what is like a Molly wine that we could make together was he just dove into my cookbook mm-hmm. and started cooking all of the recipes. And like the way that he made our wine and conceived of it was like basically just like based on this feeling that he got when he cooked through my book. And like, he tried to draw inferences from like the way that I use flavor and seasoning and herbs and brightness and whatever, and apply that to our wine. And so it really feels like this first drop that we're doing is a chillable red wine. It's like a very light, easy drinking red. And it tastes like me. Like, I don't know how else to say it, but it's like, you can tell that the winemaker just like thought about the food that it's going to get paired with, which is the food that I cook. And it's just so delicious. So I'm very, very excited.
It's so spiritual when you're making wine. You have to have an altar. You have to like think of your reference points. It's either nature or it's the country of origin. And it feels like his mood board is your book and you.
Yeah.
And you know, it's authentic. Like I think natural wine, there's a lot to be said about like the marketing of it, and some of it might come off as disingenuous, et cetera, et cetera. But I feel like it's clearly a vision of doing One Chilled Red to launch and having a really clear focus that it's your wine. It's like a Molly wine. That's kind of cool. I like that.
It's really special. Like I feel so blessed to work with someone as creative and artistic as him. And I'm so excited to share it with the world.
Dope.
So hopefully by the time this podcast comes out, it will be out there in the world, although I'm a little unclear on the date still.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. It'll be up. Okay, you do a sandwich podcast. Like, good job. That's fun. Tell me.
So fun. We love to have fun.
I mean, seriously, it's like you need fun with these things. Like, I'm hoping we're having fun here. I mean, tell me, like, is there a sandwich that you do not want to talk about? I just have to go like to that side of the coin because you have an infinite amount of sandwiches, but is there one that you just like, we can't talk about that one?
There's a sandwich that I think is like so up for debate whether it belongs on the sandwich podcast it is not one that we addressed, and yet it feels like so strange not to address it. And that is the burger.
Yeah.
And so you could have obviously an entire podcast about a burger. It could be the burger show. There is the burger show, in fact. But also for me, it's like a burger is a sandwich. And I'm sorry to anyone who thinks that it's not, but it's between two slices of bread.
Yeah.
And it's not something that we were able to tackle on the podcast because the topic just felt too magnanimous. It's like, how do you even talk about a burger when there are infinite versions of a burger? Whereas like talking about, you know, a BLT, there's more parameters around it, mm-hmm. and there are less like versions of it in the world. And so it's easier to sort of like hone in on what is a BLT and how do we like conceive of our perfect version of it.
Does a BLT need an L?
A lettuce?
Yeah. Does it need it?
Oh, of course. For me. Oh my God. The BLT for me is like all about the interplay of fatty and fresh. And so without the lettuce or without the tomato, which I think everyone will agree is not unnegotiable, like there is nothing to cut through the copious amounts of mayonnaise that should be on there and the fatty crispy bacon. Like it's cutting all of the fat with all of the acidity and freshness. And that's what makes like your mouth just pop when you eat one.
So totally love that one. And
no to the avocado for me.
Yeah, me too. I think it's too much. You got to like embrace the avocado and have it, you know, it has its own place in foods and sandwiches. Put on a torta, you know?
Yeah.
Put on a piece of toast.
Or like on a turkey sandwich, like where added fat is welcomed.
Mayonnaise of choice for the BLT. Is there, are you Best Foods now that you're west of the Mississippi or west of the Rockies, I guess it is, or are you some
I'm
other?
I'm a Best Foods person. I mean, I love QP mayo, but I actually find on a BLT that it can be like pretty intense. Like bacon is already so like umami and savory and then QP is also that. And so for me, Best Foods, which I grew up on Hellman's, which is the, I guess, East Coast version of Best Foods. And that for me is kind of like the gold standard, like blank slate mayonnaise. And so I actually made a BLT 2 days ago and I used Best Foods mayo and it was fucking perfect.
The perfect choice. I love that. Do you do anything to tomatoes? Do you pickle? Do you add a little bit of salt or are you just going straight?
I salt. Okay. So I slice them super thick. I've been like getting into the concept of like a 1-inch thick tomato because my minor BLT is actually a tomato sandwich.
And that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. And there's a bacon condiment on it, but it's not the other way around. And so a really, really thick slice of tomato, which I then lay out on paper towels and season with salt and sherry vinegar. So I like for it to be like a little bit brightened up and a little bit acidic again, because there's so much fat in that sandwich. And then those go straight onto the sandwich.
Really fun. Well, you clearly love sandwiches. I love the show's great. I love listening to what you guys come up with each episode.
Thank you. It's a lot of fun.
A couple more. Are you getting any fall cookbooks? We're talking fall cookbooks around here. It's August, of course. Is there anything that is kind of jumped out that you've received early advances for?
So I haven't received any early advances.
What's up with that?
Which I think is strange, but also like I've moved around so much in the last year. I lived like in 6 places before we moved into our house that I have to imagine there are cookbooks flying around out there. But I've been kind of paying attention to what's up and coming. I actually just a few days ago, I pre-ordered the Black Power Kitchen cookbook by Ghetto Gastro, which I am very excited about. Have you had them on?
I feel like Malcolm, who is formerly from Ghetto Gastro, Malcolm Livingston and I were tight. He was cool, but I haven't had the authors of this book. No, I need to get them on.
You should have them on. I haven't obviously seen the book yet, except for sort of like the preview and stuff that I saw online, but it looks really visually stunning. And I think that I just love the way they like look at food through culture, and it's like it's so multi-dimensional and disciplinary, and the book itself just looks really stunning. So I'm excited for that one. I think it comes out in October. And then the other one that I'm very excited about, just like selfishly because I live so far away, is the Via Carota cookbook, because it's one of my favorite restaurants in New York City, and sadly I don't get to go there anymore. And so being able to cook those recipes all the way over here in LA feels like it's going to be such a treat. So those are the two that I'm kind of like really excited to receive in the mail in a couple of months.
I feel like Via Carota, like book there. Like if you're coming to New York, you got to book there. It's so, so good.
Yeah. You got
to
go.
You have to go. Do you miss like having an office and your friends at BA? I mean, you guys were so tight. I mean, you were such a crew. There's such energy there. Do you like miss that energy?
I do. Oh my gosh, I do. So much so I miss, I mean, obviously just like friends. They were my friends first and foremost. And so it's weird to not be with your friends every day any longer, especially when we were all just like apart in the pandemic. But more so just, I miss the creative energy that that a test kitchen can foster. And I now do all of my recipe development for the club and for my cookbooks and everything in a vacuum in my home by myself. And thankfully, I have people around me that I can like bounce ideas off of. I work closely with my friend Nora Singley. She helps me on some of the recipe development, and that's super helpful. And my husband is always around, but like, there's no replacement for a kitchen full of inspired, excited cooks who are all busy cooking together, and you're all like tasting each other's food and shooting the shit and like talking about it. Like I felt like my food was made so much better just by the like creative energy around me. And so that's something I miss so much, and I'm kind of trying to figure out how to foster in my work life now that I work alone in my home.
Yeah. It's also just shooting the shit about where you've been dining out and like what you've been seeing. It's like being in the mix, and like maybe it's a New York thing too. I mean, you could start your own test kitchen. I mean, I just feel getting to know a lot of the folks from BA, or knowing many beforehand. It was a really special crew, and you guys really did something unique in terms of generating interest in food and cooking. Like, I mean, there will be plenty written about it in the future, you know, annals of history.
It was such a moment in time. And there was something, there was something really special about it all. And I'm so grateful that I got to meet all the wonderful people that work there, and I'm in touch with many of them still. So as even though they're not in my kitchen every day, which I wish they were, I feel like, you know, they're friends for life. And it was such a special experience in some ways. Yeah,
definitely. There'll be a documentary. Someone's going to do it. Someone's going to do it. Molly, we asked all guests on the Taste podcast, if you could write a cookbook or food culture book without the burden of budget, meaning you have unlimited money, or the burden of time, meaning you don't have a deadline, you could take 10 years, you could take 15 years, what would that cookbook be?
I have thought a lot about this, and I think at this current moment, it would be a sandwich cookbook that looked at sandwiches through a global lens. Like, if I had no budget and had all the time in the world, I would trot the globe and I would try to understand, like, what makes a sandwich in cultures that are not America. I feel like I have a really, like, good grasp on, like, what is and what is not a sandwich here. And, but there are so many versions of a sandwich in the world, and so many that we weren't able, we did not focus on in our podcast because our podcast was focused on the American classics. But, like, some of my favorite sandwiches are from places outside of America, like, you know, a falafel or a kati roll or a katsu sandwich. Like, there are so many incredible sandwiches in the world. And so if I had all the time and the money in the world, I would buy a one-way ticket around and I would just trot the globe and eat sandwiches in every little corner of the world and bring them all together into, like, one big tome of sandwich culture.
Love that, Molly. I feel like it would be so fun to, like, actually get to hear your thoughts on some of these, like, to actually get your quick takes on some of these places and some of these sandwiches. It would be really interesting to see how you, like, discovered new ways to sandwich. I'm following this.
Okay. Well, if anyone out there wants to sponsor me to the unlimited budget and unlimited time, I am all about it.
I mean, get on that private Hellman's private plane. I mean, come on.
Exactly. Let's do this.
Molly Baz, thank you for joining the Taste Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great to speak with you.
Eliza Barbanel, welcome back. We are doing our three things. We've not named it anything. We're still calling it three things.
I think it's good. It's what it is. It's three things.
Three things we like. So what's your first thing?
Well, I was just in Los Angeles, where I grew up, and doing what I always do, which is trying to go to all of the new restaurants that I've been following on Instagram and then seeing how it feels like to actually sit there and eat the food. And I went to Quarter Sheets in Silver Lake,
nice.
Which is a very cute restaurant that was born out of a pandemic pop-up. And I went to eat pizza, but mostly to eat Hannah Ziskin's cakes, which are made on quarter sheet trays, as is the pizza, hence the name of the restaurant.
Yeah, and you wrote about Hannah. You profiled her in Taste for a Monday interview, and you had a great conversation with her.
Oh, Emily wrote about Hannah. I just edit it.
Oh, you edited it. That's right. Emily did write that. So sorry, Emily. But what was your takeaway about the actual physical space? Because I've seen this grow on Instagram.
It's a cute space. It's off Sunset in Silver Lake, where there are so many good restaurants around there. Combi is right over there.
Yep.
And it's maybe six tables inside, if I had to guess. I sat at the bar, and I had good pizza, and I had really good cake, and I specifically had a princess cake, which I had never had before.
Mm.
Have you had one?
No, I haven't had a princess cake. I imagine it being full of buttercream.
Actually, no buttercream.
No buttercream in that cake. Wow.
Thankfully, because buttercream is not what I would want to eat in a cake form. It's a domed cake.
Okay.
And it's layers of really fluffy vanilla Genoise sponge, I would assume, but maybe a different kind of sponge. But very light cake, and then pastry cream, and then
pastry
raspberry
cream.
jam, layered up with a big dome of whipped cream at the top. And then the whole thing is covered in blue marzipan.
Wow. So let me ask you, do you recall her background, Hannah's?
I know that she's been baking. House of Gluten is the name of her pop-up.
Right.
Which is a great name for any pop-up, but especially in Los Angeles. I appreciate that she's taking a firm gluten stance.
I love it.
I'm not sure where else she was baking beforehand, but I think she's definitely refined her craft. This cake was so light, and I was like fighting with my friend to get the last slice, which normally, you know, I would try to be generous, but it was the kind of cake that incites aggression, I would say.
So tell me, how was the pizza?
The pizza was very good. It kind of reminded me of Polly G's square slice. It's a, you know, kind of a Detroit-style quarter sheet pan.
Yeah, frico on the sides. Yeah.
What?
Frico, like the cheese, like that, like Detroit-style in the pan, that like that crispy cheese.
Oh yeah. Honestly, I don't recall if that was.
Nah, maybe it wasn't. Okay.
It's possible that it was. I think to me, all of the dairy between the cake and the pizza just kind of like came together in my stomach, and I don't really remember the cheese on the outside. But it was very good. I'd recommend it.
I got a question about the pairing of the two foods, because to me, it's not, those aren't like common bedfellows, because pizza is so rich in itself, and I'm usually wanting like a little scoop of gelato or sorbet. I'm not thinking about a princess cake, but it must have worked in some way.
Yeah, it's very much like fourth grade birthday party. You know, I think that's the last time that I had pizza and cake together, which it was really great. And I think especially because the cakes are relatively light, and some of the other cakes that Hannah does often are very fruit forward. Like, it's not a heavy combination. It is kind of nostalgic in that way. I enjoyed being back in a fourth grade birthday party.
It sounds, and I'm sure she'll do a yellow cake at some time.
Yeah, I'm sure.
That's what I think about when I think of fourth grade birthday.
With chocolate frosting.
Chocolate frosting and yellow. Shout out to the spot in the East Village that does that Tex-Mex.
Yellow Rose.
Yellow Rose. Yeah. Shout out. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't wait to try it. I'm going to try to. I think she might be coming to New York and stopping by the Taste Podcast.
I hope so.
Let's do it, yeah.
What's your first thing?
My first thing is, I just got back from a couple weeks in Michigan, and I love heading back to my hometown. And I usually go in like August. And one of the things I like most about August is the apples. The apples arrive really early there. You're laughing at me because we're going a little apple crazy here right now.
I think it's too early. I'm just going to go on the record and say that that there's still stone fruit. So I'm, you know, sorry. Please continue.
No. I love the pushback, the subtle pushback, facial expression and subtle pushback. Because I have to say, in West Michigan, they come out in like the apples, the early Honeycrisp. There's actually a category called early Honeycrisp. And that was so delicious. It was so juicy. And the farmhand told me at my favorite spot, Schultz's in Mattawan, Michigan. That's like my spot. One of my two spots, Husted's is the other. They told me because of the dry summer that the juice is loose, so to speak. It is there. It is like spraying out of every bite of these apples. And I got to tell you, the apples this year have been incredible. And so I went to a farmer's market in Warwick, New York, near my home. And I went and like said, hey, what's up with your apples? They're like, no, we don't have apples yet. So what's up with it's yeah.
Did you ask why?
I did. They said we do not have them. That's what they said. That's pretty much what they said. I think that apples in the summertime, the first picks I've been told are the best.
This is a really good way to convince me to loosen my stance on not eating apples in early September or even August, because now I'm wondering what I'm missing by waiting until October to eat the apples.
Here's Eliza. What's your next one?
My next one is a game that I invented. I was driving from Los Angeles all the way up to coastal Oregon with my parents. And then once I was in coastal Oregon, I drove back to Portland with my sister. A lot of time in the car. Yeah. It was great. We listened to a lot of podcasts. And at a certain point, they just weren't hitting. And we went to a roadside convenience store. And I think I'm a visionary. The game is called Which Chex Mix Item Am I Eating? And you listen to the crunches and tell me which one.
Okay, first question. Can you remind listeners of what's in the Chex Mix bag exactly? What are the possible crunches?
Pat, I'm going to eat these on air. I hope you're not going to be offended.
I will not be offended.
Okay, well,
I can't vouch for the audience.
Here we go.
It's a food podcast, so people like hearing it. It'll be fine.
I don't know if you can hear. This is like ASMR podcast.
Yeah. We're getting there.
Okay. I don't know the names of any of them. There's like the two different kinds of Chex. One of them is light brown. The other one is dark brown.
Oh, I'm team dark brown Chex.
There's the kind of like rye crisps. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, those are great. Those remind me of like 1975.
Yeah.
Not that I know about 1975, but you know, it's like the era of 1975. Like, that's it.
They actually sell versions that are just the rye crisps, which I've had before. But then there's also two different shapes of pretzels. There's the kind of grid window kind and the circle kind.
Okay.
And then there's one like little mini breadstick.
Is the grid a pretzel grid?
Yes. And I did make my sister guess if I was eating a window grid or a circle. But that's the kind of thing I think I can do to my sister and not to my editor. So I won't make you try to
guess. Let's do one. Okay. Just one. And I'll try to guess.
I really think two is better because then you can distinguish between the crunches
we'll
in your
two.
Head. But
we'll two. Okay.
We can just pretend there's
We'll do two.
Okay, 1 second. I'm trying to. It's like which one do you throw first for rock, paper, scissors?
Yeah.
You know?
I'm always paper. I was talking to my 8-year-old nephew about that strategy for about an hour.
Okay, close your eyes.
Yeah.
Okay, here's number one.
Definitely, that's definitely the pumpernickel.
Okay, do you want to wait until you hear the second one?
Yeah, let me hear
the second one.
Okay, so first one was pumpernickel, second was dark Chex.
Mm-mm.
No.
I'm choking them down. The first one was the light Chex.
Oh.
And then the second one was a circle pretzel.
Wow, you went for the window circle pretzel, the grid.
But I would have accepted any pretzel.
God, I am bad at that game. Well, is your sister good? Did she end up?
I don't mean to brag, but I was definitely the best, I would say. But maybe that's the advantage you get from creating the game is you make something that you would like. But I would recommend if you were ever on a long road trip and you just need to do something wacky, which Chex Mix item am I eating is a game that will endear you to your car companions.
It's like Othello, like a second to learn, a lifetime to master. It's exactly like the game of Othello.
Yeah, we'll play it again.
We'll play it again. Okay.
What's your second one?
All right. My second one is I'm deep in recipe development for Korea World. We've talked about it. I'm doing the book I'm doing with Dookie Hong. And we are now at the phase where we're talking about samgyetang roasted chicken. Have you ever heard of samgyetang, this dish?
No.
This soup? Okay. So samgyetang is a tang. It's a soup of a stuffed young chicken with glutinous rice, ginseng, jujubes, scallions. It's a soup. But in Seoul, specifically the restaurant Hanbang Tundak in Hanam, we found this place that did full roasted version. So it's basically roasted chicken, or it's a soup in roasted chicken form.
Not inside the roast chicken.
There's no liquid. It's the flavors of the soup in roast chicken form. Got me thinking. So that's not my thing. That's just more of like what's in my mind right now. My thing is this. What if we thought about Korea's foundational jjigaes and tangs and thought about them in terms of other things? Like, for example, a kimchi jjigae hamburger.
Ooh.
Right? Into that. What about kalbitang, which is like a short rib soup?
Mm-hmm.
Let's put that into a fried rice or just do a kalbi fried rice. Those are my two examples. I don't know if you're following this thread, but I feel like this could be a thing that mutates and finds its way into restaurant menus somewhere in the States.
Yeah, I'm curious if you've seen any restaurants or chefs that are kind of thinking about, taking a familiar form out of a dish and then doing something different with it like this.
Like the McTorta?
Yeah.
We joke. That's the article that you wrote a month ago. Yeah. It's just a thought. I feel like taking liquid and making it into solid is a cool thing.
Yeah. I think it's almost like, I don't know if this ever happens to you, but when I make a stew and I have leftovers, I always end up having like not that much broth compared to everything else. And it's a second eating experience the next day. But it's a good one.
It's really good. You put it on rice, you put it in like some kind of other starch.
Yes.
Super good. What's your last one?
My last one is I was in a dark place yesterday, which is Soho during Fashion Week. Starving, trying to find something to eat. And I went to Zuba. Have you been there before?
No. Wow. Zuba. Z-O-O-B-A?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's an Egyptian fast casual place that is popular in Egypt. And they have, I think, one location in the United States. And it is in New York City in Soho.
Oh, cool.
And I got a spicy falafel wrap, which was very good. It had, like, harissa cauliflower. It had falafel in it, a cucumber tomato salad. But beyond that, it was just really interesting to be in the restaurant. It's like very clearly a gathering place for Egyptian people in the city and people like from that region in general. And I was just eavesdropping as people were talking about coming back from visiting their family. And it was just like, if you're going to have fast casual food, everything about the vibe was just like the opposite of the like bland,
like production line. Fresh and Co.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
There not a sponsor of the Taste Podcast.
There was no minimalism. There was maximalism aesthetically and flavor-wise, and it was what I needed it to be.
So do you think this is like a chain or a chainlet that's somewhere in Egypt or that's opened in New York?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Cool.
And I actually I met somebody whose family does it, actually, which is like a funny connection. But not sponsored, just what I needed to eat last night.
None of these three things are sponsored until you actually sponsor them, and then they will be sponsored. Just saying.
Yeah, Chex Mix. Get at me.
Was there fool on the menu?
There was not that I saw, but again, this was like laser focused on my goal of eating as quickly as possible because everyone around me was being paparazzi photographed.
Yeah, what were you doing? Like APC event? Was there a show?
I wish. I had a doctor's appointment in Soho and I forgot that Fashion Week was happening. And then I got up out of the subway and realized my mistake. But if you've never been to New York City during Fashion Week, there's just a lot of like very beautiful and practically dressed people taking up all of the sidewalk space, which is fun to watch when you don't have somewhere to be.
Clogging up the streets. Yep.
Yeah. What's your third thing?
My last one is short. You mentioned how you were getting bored with podcasts, but you are a podcast person. Hashtag podcast guy. That's not a hashtag, but just made that up. Sam Sanders has a new podcast, and I love it because I wasn't really a Sam Sanders fan. He used to be at NPR. Mm. And I was like, I don't know why. Just like wasn't in my feed. But Intuit is the new podcast he does with New York Magazine.
Cool.
And it's really good. I highly recommend it. It's high concept at times. But he did a segment about A24, which I was like, that's so well timed because it's like, why? Like he didn't just, sorry, let me back up. He didn't just do it about A24. He did it about like A24 merch.
Mm.
Which was really like a super, super niche genre and interest of mine.
Yeah, it's funny because I don't know if they have like an article component, but I did see an A24 article on New York Magazine about, did you say New York Times or New York Magazine?
New York Mag, yeah, Vulture.
Yeah, about like the brand of A24 and that like these days, which is true. You know, I went to go see Bodies, 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 which is an A24 movie that just came out. And that is the first way that I explained it to somebody when I went to go see it. Because I knew that if you've seen Euphoria or Hereditary or some of their other movies, that it's kind of like a flag you can wave so that someone knows there's a specific aesthetic or mentality behind it.
It's super premium. The merch, they do zines, which is interesting. Anyways, back to Sam Sanders. I love what he talks about. And also, I want to like toss to Pat Stengo right here. Okay. Pat Stengo does one of my favorite podcasts about box office numbers and totals.
Oh, the B.O. Boys.
Yeah, the B.O. Boys. Yeah, so yeah, I can't huge. Like let it pass.
What are your other favorite podcasts about box office?
No, the Taste Podcast, when you jump on it. That's my favorite Pat Stengo podcast. No, like let's talk about we didn't plan this, but your snap thought about A24, because I feel like you've got some thoughts on A24.
I mean, they're great. And I think you nailed it. It's they just have a feel to them that is how you explain what the movie is. That it's an A24, it's young, it's cool, makes people like me feel young and cool for going to see them. And that's what you want to give, that's all consumers want, is they want to feel young and cool, and A24 does that.
They package it well. They have like a really strong hat/bag game, like sack game.
Yeah, and they change up their logo for every movie. And people love that.
They do. That's right. I never really realized that they actually have a custom
logos.
Hmm.
So someone's getting a lot of work out of customizing that logo for every new trailer.
Now I just want to talk about A24 because I do feel like a lot of the movies are this brand, but not all of them. Like Parasite, that was A24. Right?
Released through A24, correct?
That was Neon.
Oh, it was Neon.
Oh, okay.
Which is like A24 light. They're like the little less cool brother.
So out of my depth here, I got to ask you one more question. Is horror back?
Oh, here, let me give you my one thing. I'll give you one thing. There's no food in this, but people, they'll like it anyway. Barbarian.
That's what I'm saying. Barbarian, yeah.
Barbarian. I saw it the other night. It's great. Don't ask me anything about it, because if I tell you anything, you'll like it less when you see it. So just go see in a theater. Barbarian. Horror is back.
Here's the food connection. Would you feel comfortable snacking on popcorn while watching Barbarian, or is it that scary that your hunger for popcorn is gone?
I think no. I think it's you have popcorn because then it'll give you something to like toss when you get scared to really emphasize just how scary
how scary it is. And you recommend the movie theater experience.
Oh, you got to see it with a crowd. Yeah, don't watch this at home. Go out. I mean, listen, obviously health concerns, all that, you know, but if you can, see it in a theater.
I just got invited to something about this new chef movie that's coming out. Speaking of horror.
Is it The Menu?
The Menu, exactly.
Oh, I saw the trailer for that the other day. It looks great.
It looks not great.
It looks not great.
I'm just going to say it looks not
You're
great.
You're wrong.
No, I mean, I'm just saying my instinct is that putting like a suspense inside a restaurant. I mean, they didn't know.
It hits too close to home for you.
Yeah, restaurants are already suspenseful.
I know.
Yeah, you don't want to see, you know, people doing Most Dangerous Game in a restaurant setting.
That's what it feels like, the Most Dangerous. It feels like, there's like there's hunting of humans mm-hmm. after like the first course, after the amuse-bouche.
Oh.
It's like two people die after the amuse-bouche or something.
Okay, I got to go watch this trailer.
It's kind of Squid Game-y mm-hmm. in that vibe. Pat, are we going to do a fall movie preview or a holiday movie preview?
Well, on the BO Boys, that's actually coming up. It's probably in your feed right now by the time it's airs. I didn't expect to get such a great promo spot for the BO Boys here on Taste, but I love the crossover. I'll name drop Taste on our
Appreciate
next
it. Thanks
but
for
yeah,
the
fall movie preview episode is up already.
Nah, BO Boys is a great podcast. I mean, I don't follow Hollywood that closely, but it's a great snapshot. Sam Sanders, Intuit, great podcast. Eliza Barbanel, great co-host of the Taste podcast.
It's been great talking with you. I have a lot of movie trailers to go look at.
Thanks a lot. The Taste podcast is hosted by me, Matt Rodbard. It's produced by Pat Stango and edited by Clayton Gumbert. Theme music by Steve Rydell. Visit Taste online at tastecooking.com and make sure to subscribe to our newsletter. Thanks for listening.